And I said to them, you know what? Once the cert petition was granted, which meant the Supreme Court was going to hear the appeal, it was over. It was totally over. So I said to them, we cannot let this take over our lives. It's true, it's the major leagues. On the other hand, we could write the best brief in history or submit no brief at all. And we're going to have Marshall and Brennan dissenting. We could do the best argument ever or fall down in a dead faint from panic, and we'll have Marshall and Brennan dissent. Let's not forget, this is six troglodytes and three dweebs, and it's just not going to work out for us. Our team is not going to win here. So we tried really hard not to get caught up in it. But it's, you know, there is a mystique about arguing in the Supreme Court. Well, you know, right? It's like a thing. So we ended up putting a whole lot of energy into the brief and a whole lot of energy into the argument. And in the end, do I need to say we had Marshall and Brennan dissenting? There was no choice. But anyway, it was entertaining. It was fun. It was kind of exciting. My mother came. And oh, actually, and this particular charge was a charge of manufacturing methamphetamine. So I practiced. I wanted to say to the justices, excuse me, Mr. Chief Justice, justices, could we not mention methamphetamine? My mother's here. She thinks I'm a civil rights lawyer.
You know, this has been an extraordinary interview for me, and I think it will be for everybody who hears it. And so I hesitate to ask you, because you've already said it, what you would recommend to people about becoming lawyers. And, of course, we're going way down in the number of lawyers that are applying to law school or people are applying to law school.
Lowest now since 1975.
Right, but what you said is really about putting yourself really in some way between the authorities and the state mm-hmm. and regular people. But is there any last thing in your thoughts about this, Holly?
I think you have to love gossip and love stories and love hearing stories and love hearing them more than once and figuring out how to tell that story, how to enable the person to tell her or his own story when he or she is able. Not everybody accused of crime is able to withstand the stress and actually tell it. But that's the main thing. And then you need to love codes. A lot of people who like law like crossword puzzles because they like filling in the blanks. A lot of people, as it turns out, who like law like medieval history because a lot of it is about parsing little bits of information to try to see what the whole story is and tease it out. But I think it's really more than anything. It's about liking people and wanting to see what you can do to help them extricate themselves from a problem.
Let's talk about when you were held in contempt.
I was held in contempt several times. But the one case that keeps coming back to me is one where I was held in contempt by the trial level court for not disclosing the whereabouts of a client. The middle level appellate court reversed the contempt judgment with a great opinion. That's the only one to read, really. Commonwealth versus McGuigan, the appellate court. Then the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, the highest court, overturned that, but actually narrowed the judgment enough that we could live with it. But there were a couple things about it. One is it took so long. The prosecutors really did not care about getting the information. They really just wanted to bother me. It took forever. I mean, they took 3 years to file this and then 4 years to file that. Oh, it was ridiculous. They just wanted to keep it hanging over me. And so there were two terrific things about it. One was at the trial level, the prosecutor says after the judge holds me in contempt, he assessed a fine of $100 a day. You have to tell her to pay it to the probation department. The judge says, I'm not going to do that. Why waste their time? It's just a waste of paperwork. No, you have to. Otherwise, we can't hold her in an additional contempt for not having paid it. And the judge says, I'm just not going to do that. I'm not going to waste their time. I'm not going to waste my time. She's not going to pay a nickel, not a dime. Forget $100 a day. She's never going to pay. Right, McGuigan? Not one dime. So I loved that. I felt so proud.
Well, Holly, we so appreciate you being with us. And we call the segments Lawyers You'll Like, but in this case, it's Lawyers You'll Love.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
WRCT, in sound, from way out.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
WRCT, in sound, from way out.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
What India has done in Kashmir over the last 30 years is unforgivable. An estimated 70,000 people, civilians, militants, and the security forces have been killed. What can students do? Students have been doing great work in India. They have stood up very bravely. They have been decimated. They have been beaten. Students will do what students have historically done, and they will be on the front lines, because let me tell you, this battle, no one is going down without a fight. That's not happening.
That's Arundhati Roy, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Arundhati Roy on fascism and resistance in India. Fascism in India? It's a secular republic according to its constitution, but the country under its Prime Minister Narendra Modi and his Bharatiya Janata Party, the BJP, has drifted sharply to the religious right. The BJP ideology is Hindutva, Hindu nationalism. Its mothership and muscle is the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, the RSS. It's a Hindu nationalist paramilitary organization inspired by Mussolini and Hitler, and it has millions of members. Not much is known about what's actually going on in India, beyond clichés about the world's largest democracy, yoga and ashrams, tandoori chicken, and spicy samosas. The reality is in stark contrast with the carefully crafted exported image. The BJP RSS axis has demonized and targeted India's large Muslim minority. There have been pogroms and lynchings, but people are organizing and resisting and pushing back. Our guest today is Arundhati Roy, the world-renowned award-winning writer and global justice activist. Jacobin magazine says of her, "No writer today, in India or anywhere in the world, writes with the kind of beautiful, piercing prose in defense of the wretched of the earth." She's the author of many books, including Azadi, Freedom. She spoke at the University of Texas in Austin. The moderator is Raj Patel. And now, Arundhati Roy on fascism and resistance in India.
I dedicate this talk to the increasing numbers of prisoners of conscience in India. I ask us to remember my friend, Professor G.N. Sai Baba, the scholars, activists, singers and lawyers who are known as the Bhima Koregaon 16, the activists jailed for protesting against the Citizenship Amendment Act, the CAA, and Khurram Parvez, who was arrested 5 months ago in Kashmir. Khurram is one of the most remarkable people that I know. He and the organization he works for, the Jammu Kashmir Coalition of Civil Society, JKCCS, have for years meticulously documented the saga of torture, enforced disappearances, and death visited upon the people of Kashmir. So what I say today is dedicated to all of them. All dissent has been criminalized in India. Until recently, dissenters were called anti-national. Now we are openly labeled intellectual terrorists. The dreaded Unlawful Activities Prevention Act, under which people are being held for years without trial, has been amended to accommodate the current regime's obsession with intellectual terrorism. We have all been branded Maoists or jihadis. The colloquial term for Maoist is urban Naxals, and have had targets drawn on our backs, making us fair game for mobs or legal harassment. It's only been a few days since I left New Delhi. In these few days alone, the momentum of events unfolding there makes it clear that we have crossed some kind of threshold. We cannot return to the shores we once recognized as our own. In March 2022, the Bharatiya Janata Party, the BJP, won an unprecedented second term to govern India's largest state, Uttar Pradesh. The UP elections are usually read as the semi-finals for the general elections expected in May 2024. The election campaign was marked by saffron-robed godmen openly calling for mass killing and a social and economic boycott of the Muslim community. While the BJP's victory in the elections appeared to be robust, on the ground the contest was closer than the number of seats they won suggest. The result seems to have generated in BJP workers and leaders a peculiar, untenable mix of anxiety and overconfidence. Very soon after the elections were announced, Hindus celebrated the festival of Ram Navami, which coincided with Ramzan this year. To mark Ram Navami, violent Hindu mobs armed with swords and staffs rampaged through as many as 11 cities. Led by swamis and BJP activists, they entered Muslim settlements, dog whistling outside mosques, chanting obscene insults, openly calling for the rape and impregnation of Muslim women and the Narsinghar genocide of Muslim men. Any response by Muslims has led to the bulldozing of their property by the government or burning by mobs. Those arrested, almost all Muslims, are accused of conspiracy and rioting and will likely spend years in jail. One of those charged was in jail on a different charge long before Ram Navami. Another, Wasim Sheikh, accused of pelting stones at a Hindu procession, is a double amputee and has no forearms. Their homes and offices were bulldozed by the government. In some cities, crazed TV anchors rode inside the bulldozers. Meanwhile, BJP leaders who openly provoked Hindu rioters in the run-up to the 2020 Delhi massacre were recently acquitted by the Delhi High Court, which held that there is no criminality when provocative things are said with a smile. Some of them are back on the streets in other cities, stoking similar violence. Yet the young Muslim scholar Umar Khalid is in prison. His speech about brotherhood, love and non-violence, upholding the Indian constitution and delivered during the anti-CAA protests is, according to the police charge sheet, a smokescreen for a conspiracy that led to the 2020 Delhi massacre. Apparently, Muslims conspired to riot and kill themselves during Donald Trump's state visit in order to besmirch India's good name. Through all of this, Prime Minister Narendra Modi, whose own political career was jump-started by the 2002 anti-Muslim pogrom in Gujarat, when he was chief minister, remains an inspirational figure, often silent, but more often leading the dog whistling. He is the messiah of these mobs and their holy men, who, fed on a steady drip of spurious history delivered by WhatsApp, portray themselves as victims of historic oppression and genocide perpetrated by Muslims, which must be avenged here and now. We are currently in that dangerous place where there is no set of facts or histories that we can agree upon or even argue with. The narratives do not overlap or even intersect with each other. It's myth versus history. The myth is backed by state machinery, corporate money, and countless 24/7 TV news channels. Its reach and power is unmatchable. The world has been there before, and we know by now that when debate and argument end, a war of attrition begins. Imagine what it must be like to be marked for death or incarceration. As a community, Muslims are already being ghettoized, ostracized, and socially and economically boycotted. Muslims are routinely accused of love jihad, which is conspiring to make Hindu women fall in love with them in order to increase the Muslim population. Corona jihad, conspiring to deliberately spread COVID, a replay of how the Nazis accused the Jews of deliberately spreading typhus. Job jihad, conspiring to get jobs in the civil service and rule over the Hindu population. To say nothing of food jihad, dress jihad, thought jihad, laughter jihad. Munawar Faruqi, a young Muslim comedian, spent months in jail for a joke he never made but was accused of planning to make. Any argument, any tiny misstep can get a Muslim lynched and the lynchers garlanded, rewarded, and assured of a bright political future. Even the most hard-bitten and cynical amongst us find ourselves whispering to each other, are they posturing or has it begun? Is it organized or out of control? Will it happen at scale? India as a country, as a modern nation state, exists only and solely as a social compact between a multitude of religions, languages, castes, ethnicities, and subnationalities legally bound together by a constitution. Every Indian citizen belongs in one way or another to a minority. Our country is a social compact between minorities. In the process of trying to create a political majority, that social compact is being undone by an artificially constructed, aggrieved Hindu majority that is being tutored to believe that they are the only deserving citizens, the first people of a putative Hindu nation, a majority that defines itself against the anti-national other. India is being undone. Few of us who make up this nation of minorities can put forward a neat, unblemished history of ourselves in which we are blameless victims of aggression. Our histories intersect, interlock, and aggregate. Together they make us who we are. Other than the overarching hierarchy of caste, class, religion, gender, and ethnicity, our society is hierarchical at a molecular level. There is micro-colonialism, micro-exploitation, micro-interdependence. Every thread of this tapestry is an epic that calls for scholarship, study, argument, debate, reflection. But to isolate a single thread from this weave and use it to call for mass rape, for genocide, is that something to be countenanced? When the Indian subcontinent was partitioned and hundreds of independent princely kingdoms were assimilated, some of them forcibly, into either India or Pakistan, hundreds of thousands of people, Hindu, Muslim, and Sikh, turned on each other. 1 million people were killed, tens of millions displaced. Any single story of individual or community catastrophe and misfortune, however true it may be, is false when it is told in ways that erase the other stories. It's a dangerous lie. To flatten a messy history, to rob it of nuance, to weaponize it, will have dire consequences. All of us in the subcontinent have the choice of either working toward a shared notion of justice, toward exercising the pain, hate, and hate that gnaws away at our collective memory, or enhancing it. The Indian Prime Minister, the political party which he heads, and its mothership, the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, the RSS, the fascist organization of which he is a member, have chosen to enhance it. They are calling up something deeply wicked from the bowels of our blood-soaked earth. The fire they have lit will not burn along a designated path. It may well burn our country down. The blaze has begun. Alongside the Muslims of India and Kashmir, Christians too are on the front lines of their assault. In this last year alone, there have been hundreds of attacks on churches. Statues of Christ have been desecrated, priests and nuns physically assaulted. We're on our own. No help will come. It didn't come to Yemen, to Sri Lanka, to Rwanda. Why should we hope otherwise in India? In international politics, only profit, power, race, class, and geopolitics determine morality. Everything else is merely a posture, a shadow dance. India is ruled by men who have ridden to power on the daylight mass murder of thousands of Muslims, on a series of false flag attacks and hysteria manufactured by phantom assassination plots. Certainly, there's opposition to this hatefulness from ordinary people of every caste and creed, from those who rose against the Anti-Muslim Citizenship Amendment Act, from the historic farmers' movement last year, and from regional political parties in West Bengal, Tamil Nadu, Kerala, and Maharashtra that have gone toe-to-toe with the BJP and defeated it. It would be fair to say that the majority of Indians do not approve of what is happening, but their disapproval is manifested for the most part by distaste, by a karmic shrug, and a turning away that is entirely ineffectual before the burning ideological fervor of a well-paid fascist cadre. The Indian National Congress, the sole national opposition party, only offers us weakness and the inability to take a moral position, to even say the word Muslim in public speeches. Modi's rallying call for a Congress Mukt Bharat, an India free of the Congress party, is really a call for a government without an opposition. Whatever else we may wish to call this, democracy is not the word that comes to mind. While India exhibits all the trappings of an electoral democracy, a constitution that calls us a secular socialist republic, free and fair elections, a parliament run by a democratically elected ruling party and opposition, an independent judiciary and a free media. In truth, this state machinery, including to a great extent, an increasing extent, the judiciary, the civil services, the security forces, the intelligence services, the police, and the election apparatus, is being, if not outright taken over, then deeply influenced and often overwhelmed by the most powerful organization in India, the overtly fascist Hindu nationalist RSS. The RSS, founded in 1925, has long campaigned to have the constitution set aside and for India to be declared a Hindu Rashtra, a Hindu nation. RSS ideologues have openly admired Hitler and equated the Muslims of India with the Jews of Germany. Aryan supremacy, the idea that some humans are divine and godlike, while others are subhuman, polluted, and untouchable, is after all the very basis of Brahminism, the Hindu caste system, which is and continues to be the organizing principle of Hindu society even today. Tragically, many, even the most oppressed, have rallied to the cause of the RSS, swept up by the tsunami of propaganda that has left them voting for their own subjugation. In 2025, the RSS will mark its 100th year. 100 years of evangelical dedication has made it a nation within a nation. Historically, the RSS has been tightly controlled by a coterie of West Coast Brahmins. Today, it has 15 million members, among them Modi, several of his cabinet ministers, chief ministers, and governors. It's a parallel universe now with tens of thousands of primary schools, its own farmer, worker, and student organizations, its own publishing wing, an evangelical wing that works among forest-dwelling tribes to purify them and return them to Hinduism, a range of women's organizations, a several million strong armed militia inspired by Mussolini's black shirts, and a plethora of unimaginably violent Hindu nationalist organizations that perform the role of shell companies and provide what is known as plausible deniability. As India hemorrhages jobs and devolves into economic chaos, the BJP has grown steadily wealthier and is now the richest political party in the world, underwritten by a recently introduced system of anonymous electoral bonds that enable an opaque system of corporate funding. It is supported by several hundred corporate-funded TV news channels in virtually every Indian language that are mass-marketed by and is mass-marketed by an army of social media trolls who specialize in disinformation. For all this, the BJP remains still merely the front office of the RSS. Now the nation within the nation is preparing to move out of the shadows and take its place on the world stage. Already, foreign diplomats have begun to troop to the RSS headquarters to submit their credentials and pay their respects. University campuses in the United States are the new battleground in this desperate quest for legitimacy. The danger is that those leading the charge believe that what cannot be fairly won can perhaps be purchased in an unfettered capitalist economy. The 2025 RSS centenary celebration will be an important marker in India's history. The year before that, we will have a general election. This perhaps explains the sudden acceleration of violent activity. Meanwhile, Modi the Messiah is omnipresent. His face is on our COVID vaccine certificates and on the bags of flour and salt delivered in lieu of jobs to the millions of newly unemployed. How can people not be grateful? How can they who witnessed the mass cremations and shallow graves and saw the holy Ganges flow thick with bodies, its banks lined with shallow graves during the second wave of the pandemic, not believe what they are told to believe? That if it weren't for Modi, things would have been much worse. Our hopes have been cauterized, our imaginations infected. If the RSS wins this battle, its victory will be pyrrhic because India will cease to exist. Elections will not reverse the tide. It's too late for that. This battle will have to be waged by every single one of us. The blaze is at our door. Thank you.
There's something that resonates very deeply in Indian history, in the ways that this story begins in the 1800s, not just in Texas, but in India as well. And I'm wondering if you could share a little bit about your meditations on how God and nation began in certain kinds of organizing and proselytizing under colonialism in the 1800s.
Actually, it is interesting because I briefly mentioned the idea that one of the reasons that there is so much violence now is that what is being sought to be done is to create a political majority by using religion as a rallying cry. But in the mid-1800s, for example, it wasn't that people actually called themselves Hindu, because Hindu was really a name used for people who live east of the Indus. But people would identify themselves by their caste. Are you a Brahmin? Are you a Jat? Are you a Baniya? What is your caste? And it is a society, intricate hierarchy of caste. But as the idea of riding into the capital and winning the throne by war receded and the idea of representative politics began to appear, you began to need a constituency of large numbers. You needed to form a constituency, you know, so subjects started to need to become citizens. And that is when you had a lot of anxiety in states like the Punjab, undivided Punjab, for example, where the Hindu population suddenly declined dramatically. And the reason for the decline was that millions of people seeking to escape the oppression of caste converted to Sikhism, converted to Islam, converted to Christianity. So when this demographic anxiety became a big issue, you had Hindu reformist organizations like the Arya Samaj, the Jatpat Todak Mandal, who started to proselytize, trying to keep the oppressed castes within the Hindu fold. I mean, to maintain the caste system, but to somehow prevent them from converting to other religions. And so today you have this a similar anxiety about numbers, about demography. And so One Nation Under God is what they are trying to create from what are clearly thousands of minorities, languages, ethnicities, castes, subnations, and that process of trying to create that political majority under the flag of religion is what is creating the violence right now.
The prospects of democracy under that feel very dim. And yet, India was the host of the world's largest protest very recently, when farmers spent more than a year taking on Modi's attempt to privatize certain kinds of markets and begin a process of handing over the land to large corporations. Was there not in that moment a glimmer of hope here? Because the pushback wasn't constructed in terms of religion or of God, but of a betrayal of the peasantry. And that seemed to be a really important kind of recuperation of democracy in a place where, as you say, it is vanishing.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't use the word host because the farmers' protest was not hosted by this government. The government did everything it possibly could to decimate it. But if you actually look back, I mean, I'll just take your question and take it back a little further. I keep thinking about the fact of, if you look at the history of protest in India about land, about wealth and revolutionary thinking, in the 1960s, you had revolutionary movements demanding the redistribution of land, the redistribution of wealth, the demand for land to the tiller. Now, these movements were brutally crushed. Most of them were obviously led by the left or extreme left. Then in the 80s and 90s, you had the extraordinary anti-dam movements, anti-displacement movements. So from demanding the redistribution of land, you're pushed to asking not to be displaced from your own lands. Millions of people with the big infrastructure projects were being pushed off their lands. Those movements were crushed. Then you came to a situation where the markets in the 1990s, the Indian market, all the protection was removed and it was thrown open to international capital. And you had people, obviously, with the citizenship law, the very citizenship is under threat. In the face of this, even in the 2000s, where you had what was known as Operation Green Hunt during the Congress time, you had hundreds of thousands of paramilitary flooding the forests of central India because forest-dwelling tribal land was being handed over to mega corporations. There were these vigilante armies. There were burning villages and so on. At that time, who was fighting corporatization? It was the poorest people in the land. They were being called terrorists. I mean, they did form themselves into a Maoist army where there were 50% of them were women and armed. But Maoist was a name. What they were really fighting was the takeover of their lands. The battle is still on, although the push for that land somehow has lessened because some of the corporates withdrew. So what the indigenous people as well as small farmers in the Narmada Valley were fighting in the 80s and 90s The people in central India of Bastar, mostly forest-dwelling tribes, absolutely no middle class, no money, no cell phones, no presence on the social media or fighting in the early 2000s. Now the water rose up to the nose of the very rich farmers of Punjab. And they rose up, and really it was one of the most extraordinary moments of India's history, that the farmers' movement, which hasn't ended, by the way. Because there were rich and middle-class farmers who were able to sustain that movement for a whole year, who were able to stand up to the firepower, to the media power of the government, that enabled that movement to happen while dealing with its own contradictions, because there were big farmers, there were landless workers, there was all kinds of things going on.
You're listening to Arundhati Roy on Fascism and Resistance in India. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can get copies of this program and her book, Azadi, by calling us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
You've talked about how in the Ministry of Utmost Happiness that there is chatter between two graveyards. And I'm wondering if you might be able to read a little bit of your fiction for us this evening, thinking about some of the characters who, again, are invisibilized from the discourse of Indian politics and whose voices are now inhabiting you.
I keep wondering, what do people who've never ever been to India feel when they go to India? Because it's just such a world that's so hard for people to decipher. I think the first thing that probably occurs to people is chaos, and they therefore naturally assume that the chaos of the streets and the chaos of everything that's going on there is because Indian society is chaotic, but it's not chaotic. It is the most ordered, hierarchical society that lives in the grid of caste, especially of caste. Rarely do people marry across caste or religion. Increasingly now, it's becoming a problem. So in the Ministry of Utmost Happiness, and I didn't plan it this way, just so happened that they eventually come to live together in a graveyard just outside the city of Old Delhi. And when you look at who lives in that graveyard, who dies in that graveyard, who says the prayers, it actually turns out to be a revolution, you know, because all the characters have sort of borders running through them. So, yeah, I mean, and of course the chatter between graveyards in the book and in the Clark lecture that I did in Cambridge about, which is called The Graveyard Talks Back, is about the fact that it's a conversation between Kashmir and India in some ways. And Kashmir is often described as Jannat, as paradise, and you have this paradise, this valley that is paradise, which is covered with graveyards from the struggle for self-determination in Kashmir. I think in the ministry, I say that the gravestones grew out of the ground like young children's teeth. And then you have the graveyard in Old Delhi, where Anjum, who is called in Urdu a hijra, who's like a transgender person, who gets caught up in the massacre in Gujarat, and she actually escapes because she's a hijra, otherwise she would have been killed. But she cannot go back to her life as she knew it because of the trauma of what she saw there. So she moves out of her khwabgah, the house of dreams, where she lives with others like herself, and moves into a graveyard where eventually she builds a guest house in which each room encloses a tomb. And so you have the paradise of Kashmir, the Jannat covered with graveyards, and in Old Delhi you have a graveyard covered by the Jannat guest house, and there is a conversation between them which is proscribed because these conversations are not allowed in India right now, but I guess in fiction they don't know quite how to deal with it. But yeah, I mean, I read a small paragraph maybe for you. It's about Kashmir. I have to warn you that this passage, it is written in first person because it's the voice of an Indian intelligence officer. Perhaps you could call him a product of the Nehruvian time more than now. A very upper caste, very intelligent, erudite, self-critical person. So it says, by Monday morning, the weekend body count had risen to 19. The 14 demonstrators killed in the firing, the boy the Ikhwanis had shot, Musa, or Commander Gulrez, or whatever the hell he wanted to call himself, and the three bodies of militants killed in a shootout in Ganderbal. Hundreds of thousands of mourners had gathered to carry those 19 coffins, which included an empty one for the boy whose body had been stolen, on their shoulders to the martyrs' graveyard. The governor's office called to say that it would not be advisable for us to attempt to return to the city until the following day. In the afternoon, my secretary called, "Sir, Soon Lijiye, please. Listen, sir." Sitting on the veranda of the Dachigam Forest guest house, over birdsong and the sounds of crickets, I heard the reverberating boom of 100,000 or more voices raised together calling for freedom. Azadi, 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 on and on and on. Even on the phone, it was unnerving. It was as though the city was breathing through a single pair of lungs, swelling like a throat with that urgent, keening cry. I had seen my share of demonstrations by then and heard more than my share of slogan shouting in other parts of the country. This was different, this Kashmiri chant. It was more than a political demand. It was an anthem, a prayer. The irony was, and is, that if you put four Kashmiris in a room and ask them to specify what exactly they meant by Azadi, what exactly are its ideological and geographic contours, they would probably end up slitting each other's throats. And yet, it would be a mistake to chalk this down to confusion. Their problem is not confusion, not really. It's more like a terrible clarity that exists outside the language of modern geopolitics. All the protagonists on all sides of the conflict, especially us, exploited this fault line mercilessly. It made for a perfect war, a war that can never be won or lost, a war without end.
In light of the recent attack on students in JNU in Delhi, while many student protesters continue to remain incarcerated, what do you think students can do to dissent in such times? How can students continue to organize at home and abroad in order to resist as this, you know, transnational force of fascism looms large?
Well, for those of you in the audience who don't know, one of the sites of continuous attack by this regime in India is universities. In particular, one of the best universities in India, which is JNU, Jamia Millia, Aligarh Muslim University, the Film Institute, you know, all these places where it's not that fascism is opposed to intellectuals, it's opposed to all forms of intelligence, whether it is the intelligence of sowing the seed or tilling the ground or weaving something beautiful or creating art, or these spaces where students are debating and thinking, and especially a university like JNU, which actually the reason it has been crushed is that it was a university that allowed large numbers of students from rural areas, from oppressed backgrounds, people who would never normally get an education, to get a wonderful education, to have these very, very important debates about caste between left and between anti-caste groups, sometimes ferocious arguments, but necessary ones. And this government has shut it down. It has sent in goons. It has sent police into Jamia Millia Islamia in Delhi during the anti-CA protests, who attacked students with weapons that you'd normally use for terrorists, that attacked the library, similarly in Aligarh, that arrested many people. So what can students do? The first thing I would say is that do not forget that that battle is here now to take over these spaces, because there is a great move to gain legitimacy, to gain respectability. So US campuses are being, there is a great move to try and take them over. And even in India, now they want to be published by respectable publishers who are being forced to publish these very mediocre, often plagiarized books, but all they want is the label, that this is a Penguin book or this is a whatever. So what can students do? Students have been doing great work in India. They have stood up very bravely. They have been decimated. They have been beaten. Then they suffered COVID. Now they're coming back. Students will do what students have historically done, and they will be on the front lines, because let me tell you, this battle, no one is going down without a fight. That's not happening.
A lot of people are observing that you are under attack yourself. Are wondering if you could talk a little bit about what it's like to be you right now.
Well, one of the things that I really hesitate to do is to place myself on the front lines of I'm this great martyr and I'm under attack, because everyone is under attack. I'm under attack. The stakes are high both ways. I'm protected, and I'm also, because I'm so high profile, the dice is rolled. You were asking me today, because I said it, sometimes it's just so exhausting for us in India. You know, you just wake up and feel like you have this, you have to remove this tower of weights on your chest every morning before you can even breathe, because every day someone is under attack. Whole communities, like I read, are under attack. People are being threatened with rape. People are having their properties broken down. So we can't here be like, oh, I'm so tragic, I'm under attack, I'm the only person. You know, that conversation should not happen. And when Raj asked me, why don't you come away for a while or forever or whatever, I said, because I'm not a human being, I'm a tree. I have roots in there, and my leaves would fall if I had to leave. So we look out for each other. We protect each other. We stand up for each other. So many of the names of the people who are in jail today, whose names I read out, all of them have eaten at my table. All of us are friends. But we cannot allow ourselves to be beaten down or to be frightened by this. Because in truth, the people who are the biggest cowards in the world are these mobs who go around in their hundreds or 200s beating up single people. But they are cowards. They are shameless cowards. And this, they know deeply that they are cowards.
Arundhati, you've traveled widely. You've seen struggles, thank you, from around the world, from Palestine to Kashmir. I wonder if you might be able to tell us a little bit about what is actually happening on the ground in Kashmir.
In this book, Azadi, there's an essay which was published in the New York Times called The Silence is the Loudest Sound, which was published soon after Section 370, which constitutionally guarantees Kashmir special status, was struck down unilaterally in August 2019, following which for a whole year, 7 million Kashmiris were subject to a communication and internet siege. Can you imagine what that means? Forget about hospitals, surgeries, what you need the internet for every minute of the day. That was done to 7 million people. But now today, Kashmir, as we have often said, people are living under the densest military occupation in the world. And the Kashmiri press has been silenced. It is the valley from which no news must come. Now, after the abrogation of Section 370, that valley has been opened up to a flood of what is sought to be done is like what China has done to Tibet, or what Israel is doing, which is to create settlements to overwhelm the local population with this huge influx. That is what is being planned. And yet, by the army's own reckoning, they're just a handful of militants. But it's really the whole population that is considered insurgent. So it's being really held down. It has been robbed of oxygen. It has been robbed of free speech. And now it is going to be flooded with an overwhelming presence of not just the Indian population, but also business. It's going to be just culturally inundated. I suppose what you are asking me is that recently there is a film that was made called The Kashmir Files, which sort of turned the whole history of what was going on there upside down and said that there was a genocide of Kashmiri Pandits by Muslims. It is what also what I was referring to, because there was a lot of violence against Kashmiri Hindus at the beginning of the insurrection, but there was much more violence, even by the militants, against Kashmiri Muslims. I'll read you a little passage about what actually happened to Kashmiri Hindus from this essay of mine called "The Silence is the Loudest Sound." I say, it would be foolhardy to summarize the twists and turns of how things have come to this. Let's just say that it's as complicated and as dangerous as the games the United States played with the puppet regimes in South Vietnam all through the 1950s and 60s. After a long history of electoral manipulation, the watershed moment came in 1987 when New Delhi flagrantly rigged the state elections. By 1989, the thus far mostly nonviolent demand for self-determination grew into a full-throated freedom struggle. Hundreds of thousands of people poured onto the streets only to be cut down in massacre after massacre. The Kashmir Valley soon thronged with militants, Kashmiri men from both sides of the border, as well as foreign fighters trained and armed by Pakistan and embraced for the most part by the Kashmiri people. Once again, Kashmir was caught up in the political winds that were blowing across the subcontinent. An increasingly radicalized Islam from Pakistan and Afghanistan, quite foreign to Kashmiri culture, and the fanatical Hindu nationalism that was on the rise in India. The first casualty of the uprising was the age-old bond between Kashmir's Muslims and its tiny minority of Hindus, known locally as Pandits. When the violence began, according to the Kashmiri Pandit Sangharsh Samiti, or the KPSS, an organization run by Kashmiri Pandits, about 400 Pandits were targeted and murdered by militants. By the end of 1990, according to a government estimate, 25,000 Pandit families had left the valley. They lost their homes, their homeland, and everything they ever had. Over the years, thousands more left, almost the entire Pandit population. As the conflict continued, in addition to tens of thousands of Muslims, the KPSS says 650 Pandits have been killed. Since then, great numbers of Pandits have lived in miserable refugee camps in Jammu City. 30 years have gone by, yet successive governments in New Delhi have not tried to help them return home. They have preferred instead to keep them in limbo and stir their anger and understandable bitterness into a mephitic brew with which to fuel India's dangerous and extremely effective nationalistic narrative about Kashmir. In this version, a single aspect of an epic tragedy is cannily and noisily used to draw a curtain across the rest of the horror. Today, Kashmir is one of the most, or perhaps the most, densely militarized zone in the world. More than 500,000 soldiers have been deployed to counter what the army itself admits is now just a handful of terrorists. If there were any doubt earlier, it should be abundantly clear by now that their real enemy is the Kashmiri people. What India has done in Kashmir over the last 30 years is unforgivable. An estimated 70,000 people, civilians, militants, and the security forces have been killed in the conflict. Thousands have been disappeared. and tens of thousands have passed through the torture chambers that dot the valley like a network of small-scale Abu Ghraibs. Over the last few years, hundreds of teenagers have been blinded by the use of pellet-firing shotguns, the security establishment's new weapon of choice for crowd control.
We are going to end with a question about hope, but we're not there yet. Because a lot of people want to know about caste, and a lot of people, including several supporters of the BJP who are here this evening, want to know, well, if things are so bad, and if all this bad stuff about caste is happening, how is it that the BJP wins? So I wonder if I can put that question at your door before we turn a corner.
Well, the question about caste is a complicated one, and if anybody likes, they can read a little book I've written called The Doctor and the Saint, and it explains a lot about caste. Even during partition and even now, this is what I was trying to explain to you earlier, that the way of trying to create a Hindu majority while retaining the caste system is the sort of complicated yoga move that's going on right now. But the reason that the caste-identified parties were decimated by the BJP is because the BJP understands caste very, very cannily. There was a complete mathematical change in how elections were fought and won. But the main thing about elections in India and what we call the first-past-the-post system is that you can win what looks like a massive majority of seats with a very small percentage of voters. Now, the BJP does have a large percentage of those who actually went out and voted, but if you actually do the math, it is still not the majority that it appears to be when you look at the number of seats in parliament. You know, so there's actually a big flaw in how the mathematics of this kind of first-past-the-post electoral democracy works.
Well, that sounds very familiar. But if that's the case, and you know, again, this brings us back to where we started, where there are some very painful similarities between a government that's bought by corporations or a border that transmutes into this magical place of purity that then sweeps across the nation. What hope can you offer us?
Well, I hesitate to be that person who just comes out and says, oh, there's always hope and so on, because right now I am feeling that we do have to somehow negotiate something that could look very much like destruction before something is reformed. But I'll say this, that you know, before the elections in UP, I traveled pretty extensively in UP. I went to villages. I spoke to people across castes and communities. I spoke to even the Brahmin priests in various temples, some of whom were pretty furious with the politicization of religion. And what the farmers' movement did, other than force the government to pull back on the farm laws, is to put a new language out on the streets. And that is extremely, extremely important. And I think that ultimately, people, you see how elections are won and lost. Elections are an occult art. And you have when you have a lot of money, as the BJP does, more money than anyone else. It's like watching a Ferrari race a bicycle, you know. But bicycles can go down lanes which Ferraris cannot go down. So you have so many things that were going on, which you have here too, sort of manipulating voter lists. And if you look at how close some of the seats were, 500, 2,000 votes won by. So we don't have to lose hope in elections, but I think that the battle is beyond elections right now in India. I think the battle will be on the streets, the farmers' movements, the anti-CA movement. The minute there's a little breathing space, there's a massive outpouring of rage. And that, at some point, will turn things around. I mean, we don't have to just be thinking about India. I'm just thinking about India because when you're in a traumatized situation, a traumatized place, you're just all the time trying to find a window or a pinhole of light. And I think what the world is going through, it's almost like a convulsion or a kind of illness from which I know that we will recover. I mean, sometimes when that huge tidal wave comes at you, all you can hope for is to just hunker down and hope that you're not swept away. But the wave will have to die because it cannot maintain this momentum forever. You know, it's just impossible. I think people are pretty horrified about what's happening in India right now. And while we cannot expect help from states and governments, because that is all expedient. Right now, there are many senators in India who will murmur about human rights of Kashmir or whatever, but that's only if India doesn't come down on their side on Ukraine. You know, these are just bargaining chips that people use, and India cannot take a moral position on Ukraine because 60% of its weapons and all the maintenance comes from Russia. Huge amounts of fuel come from Russia. So states are not moral entities. They are expedient entities that sometimes don moral garments. But people can be moral. We can be moral. We can understand what's going on in each other's countries, in each other's campuses, and we can stand up for each other, you know.
You're just listening to Arundhati Roy on fascism and resistance in India. She spoke at the University of Texas in Austin. Arundhati Roy is a world-renowned writer and global justice activist. She's the author of many books, including Azadi, Freedom. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are an independent nonprofit in our 36th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature voices rarely heard in the corporate media, such as Noam Chomsky, Katrina Vandenhoevel, and Vijay Prashad. And we have a series of programs with Arundhati Roy. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To order copies of today's program, Arundhati Roy on Fascism and Resistance in India, and for her book, Azadi, Freedom, call us at 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us at 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Anthony Arnov and Balaji Narasimhan. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with sitar maestro Debu Chaudhary performing raga Kaunsi Kanara.
DJ Haim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Techno Land? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Nuclear Holocaust.
It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT.
WRCT Pittsburgh. You are tuned in to It's Gospel Time. I am the DJ TYYME. That's me.
Serve you, Lord.